Hello, you're listening to Roadmap for Awakening, practical and profound conversations to support healing and spiritual awakening. My name is Fiona Moore, and I'm in conversation today with Annabelle Coote. Annabelle is the author of Returning Home, One Woman's Journey from Depression to Joyous Living Using Body-Centered and Creative Approaches in Dance Movement Therapy. And you can find this chapter in the book, The Use of Creative Therapies in Treating Depression. Annabelle specializes in the use of body-centered psychotherapy and the creative arts to help people heal and transform their lives for the better. Annabelle, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
Given the scope of your experience of therapeutic work, we could talk about a range of subjects related to healing and transformation. But what I'd like to focus on today is your perspectives and understanding about how to heal and transform depression. But before we go into this exploration, can you begin by telling us what drew you into the work of being a dance and movement therapist? What were the influences in your life that helped you know that this is your calling?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, you know, at this point, it's really clear to me that the roots of my interest in this work go way back to childhood, when the stories about me, about how I danced before I could walk, and about all the childhood performances I put on in the living room. And for a long time in my childhood, I actually studied dance very seriously. And so it was really my love of dance that eventually was what led to my pathway here. And along the way, a lot of other influences became part of it. So another major childhood influence was my love of the outdoors and being outdoors and being in nature. And both dancing and the outdoors and other kinds of creative expression really made me feel alive and energetic and really at peace with myself and the world, both in good times and in bad. And so I had that already sort of in my bones, in my body, all along as a child. And then as I started to explore, you know, kind of career questions and career options, you know, the sky was kind of the limit for me. And I was very interested in a lot of things. I actually was a biology major in college. And I love how things work. And I love the body and I love nature and was fascinated with all sorts of different things. And I had no idea that the field of dance movement therapy existed. And I hadn't been particularly drawn to the field of therapy in general or to service work. I took some psychology classes, I was interested. But when I discovered that you could combine helping people, which was something I did love, I just hadn't been drawn to it as a career. But when I discovered that you could combine that with using, you know, kind of an art form of dance and with really pulling in the body into it and being creative and having it be interdisciplinary, I was really hooked. You know, it was the first thing that I said, oh yeah, I think I want to do this. And so I pursued that. I went to graduate school and got a master's degree in dance movement therapy and counseling psychology. And then over the years, I have been really happy to find different ways to expand my learning and knowledge, both in the arts and in the world of therapy and psychology and healing in general.
Wonderful. Now, depression is so common that for many, it's considered a normal part of life. So I wonder if you could tell us what your definition of depression is and what are the classic signs and signals that someone is experiencing a depressed state of being.
Yeah, sure. So I think that depression is both very common and it's also very complex. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there's really a very wide range of experiences of depression. So there are some people who experience depression as, you know, a real clinical diagnostic kind of disorder. And then there are all the way along the continuum, all the way down to people who sort of say like, oh, I just feel really depressed today. And they're not talking about having depression. They're talking about feeling disappointed or frustrated or whatever, but it's got them feeling down in some way. And one of the things that I think is a useful way of thinking about it is that there is a continuum of depressive experiences. And that the concept of depressive suffering is something that I really like because it encapsulates kind of the whole full range of experience. And when someone is experiencing, you know, a mild sort of depression, it still creates suffering for them. And when somebody is experiencing a profound depression, it creates a lot of suffering for them. And so I think that both, you know, all ends of the continuum we can look at through that lens. I also think that there is some misunderstanding about depression and sadness. So even though sadness is actually, you know, clinically considered to be one of the features of depression, it's really much more true that depression is about having blunted feelings or having, you know, a shut down sense of emotional experience. And that's really one of the hallmarks of what depression is all about. The other thing that I think that is really important to understand about depression is it really has a lot of experience in the body. So when we look at the symptoms of depression and you sort of categorize them, you can look at the fact that somebody doesn't feel motivation or that they feel, you know, worthless or hopeless about themselves. But then many of the symptoms are also very body-based. There's a sense of fatigue. There's a sense of tiredness. There's a sense of lethargy, people having difficulty with sleep or appetite. And so there's energy levels different. So I think that that's a really another key kind of piece there.
Hmm. And would you say that depression is experienced the same for women as it is for men?
It's not. First of all, depression is diagnosed much more frequently in women. And there are a lot of different theories about that, coming from a lot of different perspectives, but it is commonly agreed upon that there's a depression rates in women are 2 to 3 times higher than in men. And that also the subjective experience or the experience of the qualities of depression are different in women. Again, there are different theories about that. There are also theories in general about how depression is experienced different culturally. And so there's sort of the gender difference that may happen within a particular culture. And then there are also ways in which depression is experienced different in different places and communities as well.
Mm, yeah. So really this starts to paint a picture that, as you say, depression is a complex phenomena and it's a moving picture depending on where we are in the planet, where we are in our gender, where we are in the lifeline, I imagine.
Yeah. And to make it even more dynamic, like where we are in the course of a day. And really, and some of this is going to, you know, tie into when we talk a little bit about the work that I do, but you know, I can have a client walk into my door and their state is very depressed. And depending on the work that we do, they might walk out either feeling more hopeful or more comforted or more energetic. And there's some shift that allows their depression to actually move just in that moment. And that happens not, you know, not just from therapy, but from, you know, an encounter with a friend or from the food that we eat or from the activity that we're doing. Lots of things are, you know, our bodies and our minds and ourselves are really dynamic experiences. And so the way that we experience just about anything can change, you know, moment to moment.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I wanted to sort of just speak to about the complexity of depression is that it is so often part of or connected to other kinds of concerns. And this is, you know, a little bit going back to that question about women and men experiencing it differently. But, you know, there's often issues related to gender roles that may play out differently. But there are also issues related to other disorders, to eating disorders, to substance abuse disorders, or just concerns with those kinds of things. Trauma is very highly correlated with depression. So there are a lot of different kinds of experiences that contribute to depression along the continuum. And, you know, kind of just general life satisfaction, kind of where you're at with the kind of things that you're doing and how are they playing out and how you're kind of experiencing yourself in the world. Those are going to play in as well.
Yeah. Now, in your chapter, Returning Home, you say that depression moves in with us, that it literally moves into our body. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by this?
Sure. When we, you know, sometimes have problems, we can talk about them and they're sort of externalized. But depression is one of those things that, you know, at its very core, it's about how it's affecting our experience of ourselves and the world. And it's very much an embodied kind of thing. So if we think about the words even that we use for talking about depression, I feel heavy, I feel tired, I feel dark or dull or empty or exhausted. These are all kinds of things that are very kind of common descriptors of what someone feels like when they are experiencing depression. And, you know, there's no way that you could talk about depression as being something other than having a really core component about it existing in our bodies. And our bodies are our homes and we take them wherever we go.
And can you speak to the physiology or the biochemistry of this, that where it's been shown that depression is a biochemical reality, if you like?
Sure. And, you know, again, there's a funny complexity here, because as we continue to learn more about these disorders or these problems, and we continue to learn more about the brain, and we continue to learn more about the interactions of the body and our experience, what we sort of seem to keep discovering is that it's more and more complex, and that we know less and less. You know, as we learn more, we also kind of realize how much more there is to know. So one of the things that, you know, is pretty commonly agreed upon about depression is that it's got multiple factors that contribute to it. So there is the biological piece. And some people have a higher predisposition to having biological components to depressive experiences. So that is one factor. But then there are other factors. So there's social experiences, and, you know, there could be environmental experiences, you know, kind of experiences of what impacts us as we're growing up and how we develop coping skills so that we can actually engage with problem solving or conflict or sadness rather than retreat from it, which is more likely to lead to depression. So it is very complex and it is multifaceted, and there is definitely biological factors there. The interesting thing, I think this is really fascinating to me, is that the biology and the psychology are really not able to be really clearly delineated, because, you know, what we know is that the experiences that we have in our body affect our psychology, and our psychology affects the experiences we have in our body. And so when you, for example, you know, kind of begin to think differently about something, and then you begin to, you know, have a more lengthened posture or more motivation to look around you, that's simultaneously changing kind of what's happening in your brain. And who knows, that might lead to a desire to exercise more, which might change some of those, you know, kind of chemicals that are happening in the brain and the body. So it's really a kind of a large intermixed soup pot of factors that really go together, both in terms of what contributes to the experience of depression, as well as what really helps to work on healing from it.
Yes, I was kind of seeing like a chain reaction.
Yes, yeah.
Well, let's break this down, shall we, a little into some of these components: the physiological component, the emotional level, the psychological, and even a spiritual level, if you like. Could you begin with bringing an example from your work, for instance, and begin to talk about how your work helped this person on the physiological level?
Sure. Well, I'll start with this case that I use in the chapter, Returning Home. You know, I think I chose this case because it's a woman that I worked with long term. And so there were just a lot of different elements to the case that helped really to illustrate different aspects of women's experience of depression. And a lot of it applies to men as well, but I was specifically focusing on women. So she's somebody who had a lot of those complicating factors. So I began to work with her when she was a college age student. And she was struggling with, in addition to depression, she was experiencing anxiety. She had a lot of shame. She was, you know, very ambivalent about the ways in which she created relationships with others. And this went back to childhood. She had some experiences of trauma. She was struggling with substance abuse. She had some relationship difficulties. And she also had some medical concerns. And actually, there was a break in our treatment for a period of time when I didn't see her. And when she returned, she happened to have developed a number of significant medical concerns, sort of chronic, very difficult to identify kinds of things. So her depression was something that had always kind of really led her to feeling things very somatically, very much in her body, which is very true of depression in general. And in her case, it really kind of developed into a very significant experience of, you know, real debilitation in her body. And the substance abuse on top of that, and sort of the poor self-care, all contributed to that. So when she first came in, she really was, you know, both emotionally depleted and also, you know, very physiologically depleted, both sort of from her experience of, you know, the amount of energy that she had and the way she experienced the world, but also, you know, kind of her system was really in trouble, and it contributed to her being ill, and she had some thyroid issues, which also were affected by it. And I'm going to go ahead and read to you her description of herself. So it talks about the physiology, but it also talks about kind of her overall experience. Mm-hmm. So she writes, "When I first came to therapy, I thought of myself as existing entirely in my head, if I even gave it that much thought. I had two main experiences of myself, one where I felt valued for my intelligence and one where I felt valued for my sexual attractiveness. So I existed as either a brain or a sexual object, but never as a whole person with a whole body, and a whole range of emotions. I couldn't articulate many emotions, and I wasn't aware of how they felt in my body. Without the self-knowledge and insight that emotional feedback gives, I stumbled through my life without direction or purpose, without a sense of how to be kind to myself. I had a feeling that life, quote, happened to me, unquote. My body was the site of trauma in childhood and adolescence, as well as an adult. And so being disconnected from my body was a mechanism for coping. In the beginning, the idea of connecting to my body was unappealing because it seemed like all there was to connect to was trauma and pain. So I think that's a really poignant description of how the depression was playing out throughout her system.
Yes, it really points to how, as you say, the depressive state is an embodied sense of identity.
Yes, and I think that the idea that the depression in some ways becomes the identity.
Yes.
Or it sucks the life out of the identity.
Can you tell us how dance and movement therapy actually works when you're working with someone with depression?
One of the things that's really important is to really begin to make sure that we're using the body first is a way to kind of create that sense of home, that sense of safety and comfort, so that we can sort of quote unquote go to work in there. So, you know, in this case in particular, it's a good example, but across the board, one of the first things that I'm going to do is help people just to kind of develop some awareness of how they are experiencing themselves and how they're experiencing their bodies and beginning really in some ways to make friends with their bodies. And the first step of making friends might be to actually just stop being an enemy and to start being curious and to bring in some of that mindful, non-judgmental awareness of the experience. And to begin to, you know, kind of just wake up the experience. And so that might happen with some very simple kind of activity, ranging from, you know, really sitting and just noticing how your hands feel, or doing a body scan, or doing some breathing exercises. And as people are able to tolerate that, and they're able to feel okay about doing that, and then they're able to start to imagine the possibility that their body could actually be a resource, that it could actually be useful to them, that they could actually use it in a different way to have a different experience of themselves and the world, then, you know, often I will add in, you know, more larger scale kind of movement experiences. And I also pull in a lot of other creative approaches to help with that. So in this case, there was a moment in the client that I'm talking about where she had done some artwork, actually. She had done some artwork about kind of her experience of feeling like she needed to hide. And there was this kind of picture that she created of her being like in a little turtle balled up with sort of these just flames going over her. And she had a sense that those flames were like all of the really intense emotional things that were really painful in her childhood. And so she was able to really create a picture of it. And then once she did that, then she was able to kind of have a sense of how that felt in her body. And she in some ways recreated it sitting in a chair. And then she was able to use that experience to kind of check in with the wisdom that was actually in her body about what other ways there might be to be in this world, and to check out that it might be safe to not have to be so curled up, and that she could actually sit up and look around, and that she could connect with me and see who was really in front of her instead of having to automatically just kind of shut off against all of those things. And then she was able to sense that, oh, she had more uprightness and she had more groundedness and she had more sense of a connection to a bigger whole. And so the artwork was really the first step and helped her to bridge, you know, kind of this almost hidden experience and help her sort of see it and then help her to be able to expand out into something different. So it really created a bridge there.
Hmm. And so the use of the creative arts, it's not that you're looking to have your client become an artist, shall we say.
Right.
But to discover the creativity that they innately have.
Yeah, for me, the working with the creativity is a really important piece of any kind of therapy. And I really, you know, I think that that's one of the things that I really value a lot about my own background in the arts is that I have an awareness of some of that creative process and how it operates. And I think that one of the things that happens in depression is that people get really stuck in sort of the first half of the creative process, which is this sort of gathering, growing, having a lot of stuff happening, and then not knowing what to do with it. And so, you know, artists will talk about looking at a blank canvas, or a writer will start about staring at the screen or the page, or a dancer will talk about going into the blank studio. And they know, they trust that even though they're not starting with something, that that eventually it's going to kind of turn into something and they can grapple with the unknown. But when people haven't learned that the unknown can actually be something that you can work through, that you can discover things through the not knowing, that becomes really scary. And that's another place in which the shutdown occurs. So helping people to tap into their creativity also, I think, helps people to tap into some knowledge about moving through the creative process, and that that's something that occurs in life. It's not just an artistic process, that the creative process is something that we use in relationships and in developing our careers and in, you know, kind of creating our own identities. And I think there's a spiritual component here too, where what we're really doing is sort of connecting with the stuff that's not so tangible, and that can be very scary for people. And so learning that that's, you know, something that is possible, I think can be a nice turning point for people.
Speaking of the turning point, was there a turning point in the work with the client you've described?
Yeah, you know, I think that there were actually a number of turning points. There was a pretty significant turning point though. And for this client, it had to do with a time when she became so depressed that she needed to have an inpatient hospitalization. And there were a number of factors that contributed to the situation, including the fact that she was in a very problematic relationship and that her own substance abuse, her own drinking, had gotten really bad at that point. And so the hospitalization was actually something that, because she had actually already done a lot of work on herself, you know, she was really able to make use of the experience less as a crisis and more as an opportunity to realize sort of how low she felt and how low her experience of herself and the world had become at that point, and to really sort of see it as an opportunity to really kind of make another layer of change in not turning to those things that fed her depression and turn instead to the things that might help her change it. And so I think that that was a really significant, like, sort of big moment for her. And then when she really made a commitment to being sober after that and to really choosing that she was going to enter relationships with friends or with lovers or with other people that really nurtured her and contributed to a positive experience, that, you know, that then she was able to really work on that in a whole new way. And that was really pretty profound. And I think I'd like to highlight, there's another piece of, you know, kind of her own experience that is pretty significant in terms of the work that we did, where she, you know, and this had to do with her tendency to sort of ignore herself. And I think that this hospitalization was sort of like the biggest moment of, like, not ignoring herself and realizing she really needed to start paying attention to herself. And there was some work that we did that became a really ongoing piece of her work. And it was really about her connecting to following herself. And the work that we did in therapy was really about actually paying attention to her belly. And she frequently had pain and discomfort there, particularly when she had had the chronic illness. But what happened was that when she, you know, she just really kind of clamped down around it. And when we really practiced seeing what it might be like to actually just kind of pay attention there, she kind of discovered that she had this gut feeling, and that the gut feeling was something that initially she really wanted to doubt and she would kind of keep wanting to ignore it. But then she really sort of had an aha about the idea of, like, what if this gut feeling was actually something that could guide you? And then she really kind of experimented with allowing her belly to relax. And then she literally, you know, kind of moved around the room with the belly being in charge. And it was this moment where she kind of really experienced what it was like to follow herself, to trust herself, to listen to her gut feeling. And that was something that was a really key turning point on a more subtle level.
Subtle in the sense that she was learning how to sense inside of herself, but concrete in the way that this helped shift the way she saw herself in the world.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's one of the pieces that's kind of interesting, because I think that when you think about, you know, dance movement therapy or creative arts therapy, there's a way in which the images that come to mind for many people often are sort of being expressive and being big. But actually, a lot of the really key work happens on these really subtle levels, and where just a different relationship to your belly changes everything. Or, you know, for her, there was also a moment where she made a gesture, a continual gesture of putting her hand on her shoulder. And it was sort of tentative and sort of seemed like it might be protective. But when we really paid attention to it, and this is where the mindfulness comes in, when we really paid attention to it, it really turned out that what she was really trying to do for herself and just wasn't being very effective at was she was trying to comfort herself. And when we slowed that way down and she discovered that what she really wanted to do was just kind of give herself a big hug, that was, on the one hand, it was a very small kind of difference between gesturing with a hand to a shoulder. But the difference between that and actually like really giving herself comfort was a really enormous change for her. And then those kind of things start to have ripple effects so that then she starts to be aware of, oh, I'm looking for comfort. Oh, where can I get that? Oh, can I give it to myself? Oh, where can I get it from other people? So it really starts to grow. You know, it's like the oak seed. It's a small beginning, but then it eventually grows into something really substantial, really grounded, really beautiful.
Was there a point where she felt that she'd come to a place of completion with your work, or is it ongoing?
At this point, she sees me occasionally. She, you know, kind of uses the work that she does with me to continue to develop in her life and to occasionally kind of go back and process something that's popped up. But she really has made really substantial shifts in her basic sense of who she is, her basic sense of how she is in the world, and her basic sense of being able to be in relationship with others in a way that feels whole, that feels nurturing. And, you know, I think that one of the answers to your question is yes, she found a sense of completion. And on the other hand, that I'm not sure that there really is a complete, you know, completion kind of that happens, that the work that we do in therapy or in our lives is really something that happens, you know, in cycles. And so, you know, I think a lot of people think about, well, I'm going to solve this problem, or I'm going to get over this grief, or I'm going to move on from this, you know, experience. And then it crops up again. And we're like, well, I thought I dealt with that. And I think, you know, it's really like there is a cycle where we continue to revisit things over and over and over again. And there are different ways that we do that. And I think, you know, it's similar to the idea of like, if you had a physical injury, you can heal from it, but you still need to do exercise or, you know, stretch or take care of your body in that way. And in the same way, therapy can be for people about, you know, dealing with a specific, very debilitating or specific, you know, somewhat troubling problem. But it can also really be about something that's a process to support ongoing, you know, healing and growth and development and, you know, really integrating the experiences of life. So it can be all of those things.
Beautifully said. Thank you for such a rich demonstration of your work and how depression can be approached in a creative and life-enhancing way. I know that you have a private practice in the United States. Can you tell us how people can find you and where you are located?
Sure. I have a website and it is movement-matters.com. And on there is the best way to reach me through all the other contact information that is there. And in addition to having a private practice working locally with people, I also work with therapists, both locally and online. And I provide consultation and supervision and other sorts of support for therapists.
Wonderful. And if someone is in another part of the States or even the world, is there an organizing body that is a register of qualified dance and movement therapists like yourself?
Yes, I'm going to give you two resources. So there's the American Association of Dance Therapy, the American Dance Therapy Association, and that is, the website there is the ADTA.org, and they have a membership directory that you can find a therapist by location on. And then the other organization that I'm going to recommend is the other major influence for my work at this time is sensory motor psychotherapy. And so that's another influence of the body-centered approach. And they also have a therapist directory, and that can be found at sensorymotorpsychotherapy.org.
Thanks again, Annabelle, so much for sharing your understanding and insights with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can find more like this on the subject of healing and awakening at fionamoore.com.